are listening to Developer's Journey, the podcast shining lights on the life of software developers around the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and I'm joined tonight by Laura Savino. Laura is a freelance iOS developer whose non-tech passion includes foreign languages and teaching. Hi, Laura. Welcome on Dev Journey.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. I've heard all very much about you, and we missed seeing each other in real life in Paris a month back. That would have been a treat, but I'm really glad. I'm really glad having you on the line tonight.
Yeah.
Do you want to say a bit more about yourself to start with?
Sure thing. So, like I said, I'm a like you mentioned, I'm a freelance iOS developer. I've been employed as a professional developer for 6 or 7 years now. I guess a interesting, somewhat little known fact about me is that before I became an iOS developer, I was really passionate about learning as many human languages as I could. And that actually translated into working as a foreign language teacher. Before I became a developer, I actually have formal training in education, specifically with foreign languages.
That would explain why you can speak French so well.
I actually majored in French and minored in Japanese, and wrote my thesis in how to use children's books for adults to learn a second language.
That's interesting. And how did it work?
So I mean, it was an undergrad thesis, so but in a lot of my reading and research, and as part of the thesis, I actually sat down and planned and taught a semester-long course to some adult ESL students, where we would go through children's books. And children's books always use a simpler vocabulary, and oftentimes they'll be illustrated, for example. So maybe a strange word will come out of nowhere and say, like, he looked behind the wall and saw a penguin. And if you're just reading text, then there's not enough information to actually figure out what that word is. But in a children's book, there'll be a nice illustration, and then that'll make it easier for you to learn a new word. And they're often written for native speakers. And a really interesting thing to try to learn about children's books, or about a culture by looking at their children's books, is that when people write books for kids, they're saying, hey, these are the cultural values that we want to pass on to our children. And so you can really pick up on the sorts of things that the culture finds to be important. I remember Korean is one of the languages that I've studied, and I picked up a reader for second graders. And one of the stories was about this kid who was really struggling because his friends all preferred hamburgers and pizza, but the kid really preferred kimchi, and he didn't understand his friends' reactions. And there's just something really, really delightful about that. That seemed to be
amazing. Amazing. That reminds me. I have a few books for my kids, some illustrations, and they're all in French or in German. But the author is often Japanese author, and I'm always amazed at looking reading the stories, because through the drawings and the way the stories are created, you see this culture shining through. It's still in French, but you still see, if you know a bit about the culture, you see it coming out of the book, even though everything was translated.
Yeah.
This is amazing. This is amazing.
I love that kind of incidental learning where you don't, you know, we were talking a little bit, you and I were talking before the show a little bit about learning new information and flashcards versus real life. And the thing that I love about these more vibrant real life examples is that they allow you to do a lot of incidental learning about the context and the culture. So you don't need to have a flashcard to tell you, like, oh yes, this is the Genkan in front of the house where you would take off your shoes before you go in, but you'll just see it and pick it up maybe as something that's in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Would that be common sense? Or is there such thing as common sense in this regard?
Ah, that's a good question. Can you say that in different words?
I mean, when you come in, then you expect something to have to do with your shoes. So if you see this, I don't remember the word you use in Japanese, genkan. And you see shoes around it, so it kinds of triggers whatever subconscious you have, and say, well, this must be for putting up your shoes when you come in, or something like this.
Yeah, and so the next time you see it, you'll be a little bit less surprised, because exactly. You'll say, oh, I have maybe some frame of reference for seeing this kind of thing before. Mm-hmm. And, like, if, you know, I know your podcast isn't all about children's books and foreign languages, although that would be fabulous, but I think this really applies to how a lot of people end up developing their skills in programming, too, because we do so much reading of code bases mm-hmm. that a lot of times that's how we'll kind of pick up these patterns. And in a code base that really functions well, we might go through and even without knowing that we're noticing it, say, oh, this, you know, I just happen to like it when this one code base divides up responsibilities really clearly. And if that's the environment that you cut your developer teeth in, you might not even notice that that's happening, mm-hmm. but you'll just develop these habits and pick up these habits. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, that's something that can be challenging when you switch teams then, is that you'll notice, like, wait, you're doing this differently. I don't like the way you're doing this. And sometimes it's not even a bad pattern. It's just different. And so it can be really hard to adapt until you've seen lots of examples of, like, okay, this pattern is actually acceptable and is totally functional for this team, whereas that other pattern was totally acceptable and functional for this other team.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to quit the children's book discussion. I read a tweet, I think today or yesterday, which was a quote from Dr. Seuss, saying that when you write a children's book, you have to reduce a chapter in a paragraph and then a paragraph to a couple of sentences and make every word count.
Oh, yeah.
And there I see a parallel with what you just said. When we're programming, first of all, we have very few keywords and compared to a normal language, whatever normal is. And then when you go to a nice code base, then you're kind of making every word count and going from a chapter to a paragraph and a paragraph to a few sentences. That's exactly the same.
Yeah, it's true. It can be challenging then sometimes because the way that people sometimes encode entire ideas into a single word. I think maybe an example of this is coming up with a custom operator to say, yes, this operator means all, like, is a very short way of describing this complex relationship or this function, this interaction. And that can be a real challenge for newcomers because they haven't internalized that relationship yet. So they actually have to go and look up more things when it's compressed to that extent.
Mm-hmm. So it's hiding the penguin in the image, but without having the image of the penguin.
Yes, exactly. Like, oh, everybody knows that when you have a red box, there's a penguin inside. Like, no, that's everybody on your team knows that. But that's...
You're right, duh.
Yeah.
No, but that's true. That's true. That's the things... I'm always amazed with people who are able to pick up a new language and just kind of a language a month and just go with it. I can go through with the basics of the language, but then mm-hmm. taking up the mindset of the paradigm of the language, how it's supposed to be written. I mean, you can write some really gorgeous Ruby, but if you write it with a Java flair, then it's not gonna smell like Ruby. And that was the biggest pain point for me going from classical managed code Java.NET to Ruby or Python. My code smelled like whatever, something else. And this is really mm-hmm. a paradigm you have to change. You have to realize, well, in this box, there is something else. It's a penguin maybe, but but it's just a different kind of penguin.
Yeah. It's my, I actually just watched a talk yesterday that Katrina Owen had given at GopherCon in August, and I believe she's citing somebody else. I'm not 100% sure, but she gives this brilliant example and talks through the difference between being competent in a language and being fluent in a language, and talks about how fluency in a language means that if someone wakes you up in the middle of the night with a flashlight in your face and asks you to implement a particular example in Go, that, for example, that you would just be able to do it without trying too hard. That level of fluency is that automatic sort of response that doesn't take a lot of cognitive overhead. I may be misquoting her. It's worth actually going to check out the talk, Mind the Gap. It's brilliant. But I really like that idea of fluency as being that it's not something that you have to really struggle over and pore over. It's something that comes, naturally isn't quite the right word, because none of this is natural, but it's something that comes without effort.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we can become fluent in many, many, many languages? Is this possible?
I think so. I guess the question, I think it's definitely possible to write fluent Java code and write fluent Ruby code and write fluent Swift code over the course of somebody's career. I would believe that it's challenging for people to switch between them without paging basically all of those patterns and knowledge back into memory. Mm-hmm. That if you're doing six, if you're writing in six different tech stacks at the same time, that some of your patterns and habits and idioms from one stack would end up bleeding over into the other, unless you're really focused in one. But that's just my guess. I haven't seen, I'm sure there's something that people have studied, and I'd be curious what their results are.
I'd be as well, but this is how the discussion between the two of us started, with English for me as a foreign language. And how I need to bring it up to my RAM in cache before I can use it. And now I can say German. If you wake me up in the middle of the night and ask me to say something in German, that would be not a problem. But now it's the other way around in English. So I need to process the information first.
But if you spent say a couple of weeks in London, it would probably change for you again.
Probably. That would be an interesting experiment.
Yeah, especially because it would involve so much travel and getting different languages really fluent again.
I need to sell that to my boss. Just an experiment. Send me a couple of months to London. That would be fun. You mentioned Go for Can. This is the Go the Can Academy conference, isn't it?
GopherCon. It's Con, C-O-N. Is K-H-A-N.
Okay, but you have something to do with the Khan Academy, right?
Yes, I was actually their first full-time iOS developer. So I worked there for a few years. Yeah, it was really interesting going to that company. From my previous work had been at a mobile agency, which was extremely focused on iOS and all things mobile. And then going from there to this company that had built an amazing reputation for their mission is bringing a world-class education to anyone, anywhere. They're a nonprofit organization that is just doing phenomenal work. When I first started there, their main channel had been basically YouTube and a lot of desktop. And so it took a lot of work talking with folks and really changing hearts and minds to say, no, mobile really is going to be a major focus of the company going forward, especially to try to reach kids these days, because a lot of people, especially around the world, are maybe more likely to have a lot more likely to have a cell phone than to have access to a desktop computer. So it was really fascinating being there and helping to revamp and build out their iOS apps, and just watching as the company and participate as the company spent more of its focus bringing things to a mobile platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Khan Academy and all those MMOCs, or is this the term?
Yeah, I think people often just pronounce it MOOCs.
Okay.
Speaking of of shorthand that maybe obscures your meaning a little bit.
That's all right. It's really amazing what's happening in all this field of online learning and sharing of really high level information. That's really something.
Yeah, absolutely. But something that I know that the folks there who are research, something that's really important to them is not just taking previous models of education that are, you know, hey, we have this textbook. Look, now we have the textbook as pixels on your screen instead of ink on a page. That's really not taking advantage of the kind of rich interaction that that technology can support. And you know, and we've all seen those iPad apps for kids that you'll number and make something happen, and then the reward is that there's lots of animations on the screen, and that will keep kids looking at the screen. But there's something important about accessing people's intrinsic motivation to learn more things and to really engage with the content and to find that deeper meaning and pleasure and motivation in the things that they're learning.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge challenge.
It is. Have you been involved in such UX research or kind of A/B testing of apps in this way?
No, I haven't on that scale. I have been thinking and speaking actually recently a lot about education in a totally different slice of life, which is in conference speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, my background was in teaching, and then I became a developer and was heads down just writing code for a few years, and then slowly started getting into conference speaking. And before my first talk, I was super nervous. And then got up in front of the room and realized, oh, wait, this is basically just teaching. Like this, I can do this. This isn't something that I want. Once I got into it, I didn't have the stage fright or anything anymore. And something is that a lot of us, I mean, as developers, we like to kind of do our own research and come up with our own theories about what would make, for example, an effective presentation. But I realized that there are all kinds of insights from this field of education that's existed for centuries that we can actually just borrow their ideas and bring them into our conference presentations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I've been speaking about on a high level and also started giving workshops on is, hey, let's, instead of just thinking, how can we stand up and deliver content from me, the speaker, to you, the room full of people, how can we get people to really work with it? What can you do in terms of setting your own goals and providing materials for the participants that will let your content really sink in and change their behavior? I mean, secretly at the bottom of all this is, are conferences even helpful ways to communicate information at all? And I suspect in a lot of ways the answer might be no. But they're still valuable for bringing people together. As long as we have conferences, I'm trying to work with people to figure out how to make their presentations more, that it's more educationally sound.
Mm-hmm. I did my first attempt at poetry slam at a conference we are hosting in here in Germany, and
Really?
the opening keynote. Yeah, that was very scary.
Wow.
I'm quite used to public speaking, but that was a whole different beast. but it went out all right, and the whole point of the slam was actually to there was a playing with words, basically, on the difference between a participant, an attendee, a speaker, a non-speaking attendee, and a non-participating speaker, etc. So basically, just saying the act of being at a conference is not even half of the work. The act of attending to conference speaking talks is also not really interesting. The whole point of being at a conference is in the aisle and just talking to people and trying to get
Absolutely.
People right away in the conference to thinking about this. And that was really scary, but efficient or effective.
People that's great.
Really, really started connecting and discussing with one another. That was really good.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I've been to a couple of conferences where someone is brave that way, not necessarily as a poetry slam, but that reminds people, hey, you're here to meet each other. And there's something about having that explicit permission to, yes, go talk to people in the lunch lines, mm-hmm. invite people to share your table. And even though if you would have asked people before the conference, hey, is meeting people important? They all would have said yes. But something about someone standing up there and saying, hey, y'all should go meet each other, actually makes them do it. So that's yeah. amazing that you stood up and did it and had that effect.
Yeah, I wanted to try that, and we've done it in a different way with some friends. We went to a conference in Berlin, and it was a very management level conference, so a lot of people with suits and ties. And one of the first things we did was to start making a sign on our name tag. To say, if you see this sign, I'm okay with you. In German is a different word for one person or how is it in English? You don't have that. The polite form the common form. Uh-huh. And all those managers were using this polite form, the Z in German.
Ah.
And this just makes a build up walls between people. And when you start using this, it's just awful. You don't get a connection between people. And so we started hacking the conference this way. And at the end of the conference, I guess there was only a handful of people who didn't have the sign, this sign on their name tag. And it was just amazing how much people connected through this.
That's awesome.
That's something I really try to do now at conferences is try to hack the thing right away and get people talking.
Wow, I'm sad that English doesn't have such a clear signal. The closest thing that I've seen to that was a couple of folks. It was William Van Heck and Victoria. I'm going to get her last name wrong. Victoria Wong. They made buttons for. To communicate something sort of similar, which the buttons had little drawings of cats on them. And the cat was either like had both paws, arms out having a party, or was like peeking out from behind a wall. And I think there was a third one also, but you, based on your desired level of social interaction, would pick up one of those pins. And it basically meant, hey, like the cat hiding behind the wall meant, hey, I might not come up and talk to you, but I am totally friendly if you come up and talk to me. So that was, yeah, but I like the idea of encoding that in every single interaction. Like when you just start talking to somebody, if you're using du instead of sie, that it's just understood, hey, I think we should be friendly with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it kind of makes it's sometimes harder to connect because when somebody starts with Z, then it's a bit harder to just go back to you to having a do in there. But when it happens, yeah, you're right. That's really, it makes this a really, friendly from the get-go, I would say.
That's really nice. That actually reminds me, it was something that surprised me a lot at the conference that I was just at in Paris, because, you know, when I learned French and when I spent some time there in college, college students call each other to, like, all the time. Like, they use the more informal phrase. But I always assumed that grown-ups, kind of everybody would switch to using vous, to using the more formal level. But mm-hmm. at this conference, I noticed, like, so I was trying to vouvoyer people, to use vous with them. But everyone who started a conversation with me used tu. And mm-hmm. it surprised me a lot. Is that something that, do you think is associated with tech people, and like we wear jeans and t-shirts and so we also use tu? And that also sounds different from your experience at this conference in German.
I think that might be the tech, and even more the conference you went to, Newcraft. It's a specialized conference on craftsmanship, and maybe there's a sense of family.
I see.
Being there. So maybe there's this this meta level on top of it, where people assume, well, if you are here, then you're already on the right side.
Wow.
You're not on the dark side of the force. You're all right.
I see.
Maybe two is all right then. Well, I don't know. In French, yeah, you would use vous as well in some more formal context. So I don't know. But it's interesting. Before I went on this tu and vous stuff, you were saying, public speaking, we should pull onto what has been done in the past. We should reuse those proven ways of presenting and teaching. Do you have some examples about that?
I absolutely. One of the first things, and this is actually something that starts even before you start planning out what you're going to say. I make an analogy in terms of a lot of us are more familiar with software design or app design, and we know that there's a difference between wireframing out what the UX will be and then going in and really polishing the design, right? Like we know, okay, we're going to decide what the transitions are and what buttons go where and how exactly to implement the feature. And that gets sketched out maybe just in black and white. It could be on a napkin. And you could show the interaction, even if you use one of the prototyping tools, you could show the interaction. But it's not, you haven't fine-tuned all your animations, you haven't chosen a theme for your colors and things like that. That's more of the end polish. Mm-hmm. And so we understand that there's a difference there. And you can talk about a sort of similar planning with public speaking, that you will say, okay, I want this section to transition into this section, and then this content really belongs together, so I should make sure to do that, and then also to have the callbacks and things like that. That's more structural. I think of that as like the wireframes of the presentation. And then on the visual polish side of a presentation, there's the, okay, what do my slides really look like? Do I have the color theme? How do I stand? Do I make eye contact? And things like that. But to me, a lot of the lessons that I've taken from teaching happen before any of that gets started. And with app development and software development, I'd call this the step of saying, hey, who is our audience and what feature do they actually need? Do they actually even want the thing that we're about to go wireframe and build? And with presentations, that looks like saying, hey, what's the information that this audience is missing? What is it that I want them to be able to learn? And then going into saying, all right, what's my content going to be and how exactly am I going to structure it? So that's what I'm pushing on people to really consider before they start planning out their presentation and saying, hey, here's my structure and it will be a fancy speaker approved structure. but to really step back and say, and have a learning objective, which is where teachers start all the time, is say, what is, after this session, what is the thing that people are going to be able to do that they couldn't do before? Mm-hmm. And that's something that is really easy to skip, because as presenters, sometimes we think, okay, I have to cover such and such. I have to cover core data. I have to cover this. But if you take that a step back and say, after this session, people will be able to persist this kind of data to disk and will be able to debug exactly these kinds of issues. It really makes a difference in how you approach your material. The maybe more accessible to all developers would actually be a language example, which is that when I was teaching French to little kids, I would never say, okay, I'm going to cover the numbers 0 to 10 right now. Instead, I would say, all right, by the end of this lesson, my students are going to be able to exchange phone numbers in French and write them down. Mm-hmm. And just these extremely specific examples of what people will be able to do at the end of your session.
And did you devote that to the students, that this was the objective?
That's a good question. We might, in the case of the kids, I wouldn't be so formal. It'd be like, hey, this is what we're going to practice doing. Mm-hmm. I think that with professionals, when you're teaching professionals, it really helps to tell people, especially if it's a multi-track conference or something, to be really upfront. These are the skills that you're going to walk out the door with, so you can decide whether it's a good use of your time to come or not.
Yeah, that's something you would want to write in the abstract and have really clear, so the expectations are set up right, I would say.
Absolutely.
Personally, this has been bugging me. I love to create talks that are kind of going crescendo and building on something. Mm-hmm. And I always have this dilemma. Am I doing something kind of hiding where I want to go so that people get this aha moment at the end, but then risking that nobody shows up because they don't know where this is going, or divulging this from the beginning and then using different means to make it fun and interesting why do you think people don't do that? This whole preparing, thinking about the what you want to get out of it, and thinking who is your target and where do you need to start to get people on board, etc. Why is it not common sense to do this?
That's a good question. I don't know why people don't. I have noticed that in talking, even seasoned presenters, these ideas, after hear about it, they say that makes perfect sense. Why would you do it any other way? But I think until you've thought about it from that perspective, a lot of the examples that we have and a lot of the culture really is around making talks that are more about documentation than learning. It's the sort of talks that you're maybe expecting to go back and watch again once you have a question about this technology, that it's that it will answer some questions, but you're not really expected to leave having internalized all of that information.
And how important is for you the slide deck versus the voice on top of it? I mean, I see a lot of conferences, slides are put on whichever platform you wanna use. But I mean, actually, with my slides, you couldn't start anything with it. Almost everything is in the audio. Almost everything is what I'm giving out speaking.
That's my pattern too, for sure. That I will basically write out essentially a blog post first, mm-hmm. and then turn those stories into something with a structure, and then at the end I'll break them apart and put some words together just so people will have something to look at, I guess, and illustrate things a little bit better. But that was something I got to take a speaker training class one time, and that was something that they really emphasized, was that there are two completely different purposes of slide decks. And some people make a slide deck whose purpose truly is documentation, that you should be able to pass it out and people will be able to reconstruct your content based on the slide decks. And that's really different from a slide deck that's used to support a live performance. Mm-hmm. And that one isn't bad. It's not bad to have a document that has all of your content, you know, with some photos interspersed and some well-organized thoughts. Like, bullet points are not inherently bad. They're just, but they are more documentation than performance.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Why did you start with public speaking in the first place?
It's a little bit strange, actually. I got to be coincidentally friends with a few people who were speakers, and they kept saying to me, like, "Oh, Laura, you should totally give a talk." And I said, "You know, I've only been doing this. I've only been coding for like a year and a half. I don't think I would be very good at it. I don't have anything to say." But then, surprisingly, I was at a conference and saw a talk that was super mediocre. Like, it wasn't bad. It was just, I really like the French expression. It was très, très moyen. Like, it was just really, it was really middle of the road. And I looked at it and said, like, wait a minute, I could do that. Mm-hmm. Like, I might not be able to give a great talk, but I could definitely give a middling talk that in my capacity. So then a couple of weeks later, Dave Klein, who organizes CocoConf, also said to me, "Hey, Laura, I'd really like you to come give a talk here. You should submit something." And having that vote of confidence from a conference organizer specifically inviting me, and having seen this talk that was kind of so-so, but that I knew I would be able to do at least as well as, actually, that was what motivated me to get started. And honestly, that's something that keeps me, I don't know if this happens to you, but for me, I still start doubting myself before I'll give a talk, right? I'll say, "Oh, like, why am I here? Does anybody want to see this? What if my talk is just really, really mediocre?" And then I'll think, well, maybe my talk will be really mediocre, but there's going to be someone sitting in the audience who's never given a talk before. And maybe she'll say, like, whoa, I could do that. And then maybe she'll start speaking, and I'll inspire someone that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely my experience. I've given many talks in the past years, and some of them bunked completely, and I got really terrible ratings. Well, not terrible, but très moyen. And at every one of those conference talks, there was at least one person who came after and said, "Well, thank you. That was amazing. And I realized something." And so even if the ratings at the end are really not what I expected, and sometimes went bananas, but sometimes it's not, just not that day, there's always somebody who's going to be moved by that. And this makes it worse. I mean, that's...
Yeah, it's true. And that comes right back into the teaching where, you know, if someone is able to get some value out of it, that's, at the end of the day, that's what matters. That's one of my favorite things that Kathy Sierra talks about is that she has I think it's a blog post called "Presentation Skills Considered Harmful," and she talks about how the presentation ultimately, it's not about you, the presenter. It's about what the audience experiences. And so if someone in the audience gets to learn something, that you succeeded, because it really was not about making yourself look good. It was about helping. It was about helping the other people in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. While we're still on the live performance, I heard your conditional breakpoint.
Yes, right? It's true. It was a dream of mine. I guess a little background, because somehow not everybody is familiar with the Billboard chart topping James Dempsey and the Breakpoints.
Everybody.
No, they actually did. He released an album that charted in comedy.
Yep.
But yeah, he composes and performs original songs about programming. And he's just a brilliant performer. Like you picture an engineer performing songs about programming and you might think like, oh, I bet they'll be a little bit funny, but you're not picturing somebody who is a master performer as well. And James he just blows it totally out of the park. But yeah, as he performs, you know, it used to just be him. When he was an engineer at Apple, he would sit at the end, he would present at WWDC, he would present some new API, and then at the end of it, he would sit with his guitar and sing a song about the API that he had just introduced. One of my favorites is I Love You, which is about, it's a country song that is about how much he loves NSView. It's amazing. They're all amazing.
Okay.
But that was how he got started, and now has this whole band made up of, as James goes around to different conference country, he'll have basically a pickup band of whatever developers are at the conference who also play instruments. Mm-hmm. And they will play along with him. They'll practice a little bit and then they'll be what he calls a breakpoint jam. And if you only perform with a band sometimes, you're a conditional breakpoint. And that's what I am.
Mm-hmm. What instrument do you play?
So I've mostly, I got my start doing backup vocals. Mm-hmm. And actually just recently learned guitar, which is another awesome thing about these breakpoint shows, is that several of us who play with James, our first ever public performance has been as part of a breakpoint jam. So it's been just an awesome way to get brand new musicians out there and getting to perform while singing songs. So good.
How was it going on stage? Was it something different than doing public speaking?
So I did a lot of thespians in high school, and I've been in choirs for kind of forever, and I used to play piano, so the stage thing was pretty cool for me. But the main difference was singing on stage in a way that other people could hear me, not exactly a soloist, but people could definitely hear my voice, and that I was surprised to realize how much being nervous affected my ability to use my core muscle to support the sound enough that I didn't go off pitch.
Mm-hmm.
got to learn a lot more about how to listen and how to stay on key and how to sometimes make mistakes and then not actually worry about it. Because it's just so much fun.
I can relate to that. I had a couple of talks, a bit bigger audiences, etc. And you can hear it in the first words you say. You can feel the emotion rushing through, and then the stage fright rushing through, and then you just make a pause, and 3 seconds later you are on, and everything is fine. But I picture that singing, you just cannot pause. You have to continue. And
it's true.
I'm just freaked out with doing this.
I mean, maybe you'll intro one of your other conferences instead of doing a poetry slam. Maybe you'll have like a little ditty that you sing to get to convince people to talk to each other.
I'm putting that on my not to do list.
We'll see. Understood.
No, never saying no. Never saying no. No, that could be something. I need to ponder that though. great. Will you be playing for the breakpoints again at some point?
Oh, every time that James invites me, I jump at the chance. So we just performed at WWDC last week, which was awesome. We raised we met our goal of $35,000 for AppCamp for Girls, which was amazing. It was a fundraiser conference or a fundraiser concert. And he said that he would be back next year if they'd have him. So I've got my fingers crossed that I'll be able to do it again.
And if he's back, then you are back as well.
Yes. if he'll have me, I don't want to presume.
Okay.
And it's just been a wonderful way of getting to know other developers in the community. There's people like John Fox plays the drums. I'm sure he's a fabulous technologist in a lot of ways, but I literally only know him as a drummer. So it's a great way to get together with other nerds and just get to make music.
Cool. You just spoke about the App Camp for Girls. What is this?
So it is a US organization that puts on week-long day camps for 7th and 8th grade girls, which is, I guess, 13, 14. And they learn within a week, they learn their way around Xcode and actually follow a template to make an app that they present to a board of potential investors by the end of the week.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it's a really great chance to it gets kids at that age who might otherwise not think of themselves as being technical people. It really gives them a chance to use real developer to make something. We show them that, you know, design is part of apps, and so a lot of them get to draw, because they draw all of their app icons are hand drawn on paper and scanned in, which just gives them this amazing look. But then on the other side of that, so, I mean, people talk a lot about how, like, yes, there are way fewer women in tech than there should be. And so one way that some folks are trying to solve that is by getting girls more involved in programming earlier on. But something else that we all know is true is that there's lots of women who start off in tech and then leave very quickly for a lot of reasons. And to me, one of my favorite parts about App Camp for Girls is actually the support that it gives to all of the mid-career and early career women who participate as team leads, as lead developers, as organizers, and who get together and just meet some amazing people in the field who are doing excellent work that you might not get a chance to interact with otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I think it just gives great support across the board.
Mm-hmm. So not just for the attendees, but also some kind of networking and cross functional support for the organizers as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been actively organizing this beyond doing fundraising, right?
So I participate in, I'm kind of a floating volunteer in whatever ways they need me. I've led a couple of workshops in Seattle teaching the campers how to ask a good technical question, rather than, you know, you don't just wave your arms and say, I need help, but you say, okay, here's what I'm trying to do. Here's what I tried. Here's what I expected to happen. You know, teaching them workshops that way. I was the lead developer in Portland last year for one of their camps, which meant that I got to show the campers how to use Xcode, and also answer some technical questions, but not so many that, you know, I couldn't just give the answers to people. So that it was really a teaching moment. And this year we have a brand new camp in Chicago that I'll just be behind the scenes helping the people who are the organizers and the boots on the ground sorts of folks there. I'll be providing backup for them along with Gene McDonald.
Cool. I love how we've been talking for a very long time without mentioning much about code, but talking about tech the whole time.
It's true. It turns
impressive.
Out. Yeah.
Did we miss something? Did you want to speak about something that we didn't touch on?
No, I think this was a wide ranging conversation.
So it was.
Yeah.
Where can we find more about you?
So I have my website is savinola.com. It's just my last name, SAVINOLA.com. And that's mm-hmm. who I am on Twitter and most things.
Okay. Do you have some talks coming or something you want to plug?
The next thing that I really want to plug, I think I already mentioned that this app camp in Chicago is coming up as of right now, mid June 2017. We still have a couple spots open for campers. Mm-hmm. So if participating in that kind of camp is something that people would be interested in, the Chicago-based kids, that's definitely something to check out and to spread the word about.
Okay.
The dates for that are, it's late July, so that will be, I should have this on the tip of my tongue, but I don't want to lie to you. July 24th to July 28th. There's and it's always exciting in a brand new city to go in and get to know the local development community there.
Mm-hmm.
But
you'll you'll be heading there yourself.
Yep.
Oh, cool. I've spent half a year in Chicago. 2005.
Oh, so nice.
That was gorgeous. I really loved the city.
Yeah. Well, but if you know people who've got 13, 14-year-old girls, send.
I think it's not long enough. It's been only 10 years, so it must
I
be
see.
Only 10. But I'll put the link in the show notes and all the information. So
awesome.
Somebody
thank you.
Listening to this can pass it on.
Great.
Well, thank you very much, Laura. That was an incredible talk with you.
Ah, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
And we'll speak again sometime on Developer Journey, I'm sure.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.